Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage. I'm Chet Haas from the Android UI Toolkit team, and we don't have Tor this week, but we do have special guest.
So I'm Romain Guy from the Android Graphics team.
And we also have regular guest.
I'm Mathias from the Android Graphics team.
Actually, Mathias is being a little shy. He was the graphics team for many, many years.
That's true. I think when I got here, he was the graphics team, right?
Yes.
What, 7 years ago? Right.
Yes.
Okay, so what did that mean at that time?
What does that mean? So it means that I was alone all by myself to do all the Android graphics infrastructure.
Okay, so I think it's a little hard to understand from outside, because when we talk about graphics, we mean one thing, but there are many different aspects of graphics. So for example, the UI Toolkit team does a lot of graphics as well, down to a certain level. Right. So
yes.
Like we issue GPU commands to draw the stuff for Canvas or whatever. But there's a whole other graphics layer that handles.
Yes. So that's that other part was what I was working on. So basically it was, how do we get the hardware to do its job? So that includes two parts. There's the sort of the GPU driver part. And then once we have the graphics rendered, how do we get it on screen? And so that's what Surface Linker did.
Does.
Yeah.
Okay.
Still doing it. So
there's Surface Linker, but there's also Hardware Composer.
Yes.
Like, what's the distinction?
So I was gonna talk about this. So what we had at the time is that a lot of the hardware in the original phones had special hardware to display essentially bitmaps, so or windows on screen, and so we wanted to take advantage of that. It existed before on the PC, and we used to call that overlays. So basically, it's a certain number of frame buffers, usually 3 or 4, that the hardware can draw on its own without any other intervention.
We used to call them overlays. Don't we still call them overlays?
Well, I guess it depends. We can still call them then. And the problem with overlays is that they have a lot of different capabilities from hardware to hardware, and lots of limitations, like in terms of the width or the height of the bitmap, the overlay you can use, or the color formats, or sometimes they can scale, sometimes they cannot, sometimes they can rotate, sometimes they cannot, and the matrix of what they can do, it can be very complex. So traditionally, before Android, the way this was working is that the hardware would advertise what it can do, and then the framework would try to, you know, figure out all of that and map it to what it needed to do and configure the hardware to do that. And then that meant that the code on the framework side was really, really complex, because it had to understand all the matrices of what different pieces of hardware could do. And we changed that in Android, and I'm really happy with where we landed. And so what we did instead is we decided, okay, we're going to build a structure that's going to describe what we want to do. We're going to send that to the hardware driver, and it's going to respond back with, this is what I will do from what you asked. And the delta we would do in software or with the GPU.
Okay, so this is the case that sends us from being supported in overlays to being GPU composited?
Yes, so we would try to do most of the work with the overlays, because it's generally more efficient. And we would do that by telling the overlay hardware, okay, this is what we want. And then it would respond by saying, oh, this is what I will do. And we'll compare which windows it couldn't do. And we would do those by hand, using the GPU.
Yes, so more precisely what happens is that we send a list of what we call layers. So each layer is basically a window from an application. And the response we get from the hardware composer is for each layer, whether or not the hardware composer will do it.
Okay. And I remember some of those constraints being like in landscape mode, like you talked about rotation. That was one of those things, like, do we need to pre-rotate or are they going to rotate
yes.
for us? The place where I tended to trip over the distinction between overlays and actually doing GPU composition was if there are too many layers or windows that we're asking for. So, for example, in a typical situation, you may have the status bar, the nav bar. Those are separate windows, right? So there
yes.
goes two overlays. And then you have a wallpaper, and then you have launcher.
That's four, right,
right
there.
Right. Yeah. And then if you have an application that is translucent on top of that, then all of a sudden you're going to be doing some GPU composition. You want to try to avoid that. Or dim window is a typical thing that
yes.
would cause it. Dialogues that pop up on top, all pop-up windows.
Yes, another thing that this mechanism allows is to it puts some control in the hands of the hardware vendors, which is a good thing because that gives them an area where they can compete. Because in fact, there's a lot of smarts that they could put in their drivers for the overlay hardware, and decide. And there's a lot of opportunities for optimization, taking advantage of every pieces of the hardware. Because the great part of this is that we don't have to know what the hardware can do, because the only thing we say is what we want. And so then they can leverage some pieces of hardware that are not even there for graphics, if it helps somehow, some DSPs or whatever, we don't even have to know. And so I think that ends up working really well. And for example, some drivers will do things really smart, like, oh, you know, it's been a while, this window is not changing, so, oh, you know, we will stop using the overlay because that uses battery. And since it's not changing, maybe it's okay to do it with the GPU, stuff like that. And there's tons and tons and tons of optimizations and for performance and power that the vendor can do using what's specific to their hardware that we don't even have to know about.
Right.
So that turned out really well.
So back when I got here, when you were the graphics team, four was like a typical overlay amount. And I think that
three or four, yes.
That was true for quite a long time. Is that also true now? Is that typical still?
I think so.
It's still true, yes.
Okay.
And I think what's happening now is the higher resolutions, it gets more tricky. You could have, for example, maybe you'd have five or six overlays, but they're limited in width. So when your window is like more than a certain size, it has to use two, you know, internally. So in fact, the number of overlays is not even something that really means anything because it depends on
okay.
a lot of things.
All right.
I think a good example was Nexus 10, right? That's what was happening. We're
yes.
using several overlays because the resolution, it was our first device using the 1440p screen.
The technical term was too many pixels.
Too many pixels,
yeah.
yes. And that was limiting the number of overlays because the hardware had to use more than one
right.
in some situations.
So just to bring this back into reality that other people might have experienced in the past, like one of the problems with when you bump out of overlays into GPU, it's not necessarily a bad thing because GPUs can be really powerful, but the bad effect that we have seen, at least back in the day, was that if you are using the GPU for rendering into one of these windows, like you're doing an animation and therefore you're issuing a lot of OpenGL calls, and then the system is also trying to do things like animate windows into place using necessarily GPU composition because you ran out of overlays, then all of a sudden you start to thrash between them.
Yes. In fact, there's sort of two downsides not using overlays. So one is obviously you're taking GPU power performance out of the app. So in one case, the app would have all of the GPU for itself. And in another case, it wouldn't. On some architecture, it's less true now, but it used to be that context switching between
right.
different GL contexts was not so fast. And I think it's not a problem anymore. But and the other problem is that it also adds latency. because that's the because there's essentially an extra composition drawing step which you wouldn't have when you use overlays. Because overlays, from the point of view of the app, it's just like if they were drawing into the screen directly. So you get a little bit less latency. Usually you get one frame of latency extra, usually, when you do GPU composition. It's not completely true, but...
But not, it's not also about just the number of overlays. It can be about some of the features that are turned on. So a good example is, you know, we have the nightlight, or for accessibility, we have color blindness simulation or compensation. And those, we try to do that in the hardware composer if we can, because a lot of them, we can just give them a color matrix and we say, like, please apply that color matrix on every pixel on the screen. But for some reason, some devices might not be able to do it, so then we'll be in GPU all the time. And a good example is the color management that we introduced in Android O. If your application declares that it wants to do white color gamut rendering, the way we implemented it cannot be done by the hardware composer yet. Or at least there's no hardware composer that I know of that can support it. So we fall back to GPU composition in that situation. It's a partial GPU composition in a way, but...
It's the weird world that we live in, where we try to take advantage of the resources that are there, but we also need to help lead the industry toward things that they should be doing, right?
Right. And I think one of the reasons why the hardware composers that we have today are really, really good is not only because, you know, the hardware vendors are innovating and investing in those areas, but also because Android makes such a good use of them that there's a lot of value in making those hardware composers better.
Yes, and I will add that in the past, overlays were mainly used for video playback. That's another thing they do, usually much better than the GPU. And so, you know, hardware would have a couple overlays that did YUV or whatever, so you can optimize video playback. But we started to use them for window composition, which I think did not really exist before Android. And the side effect, or the good side effect of that, is that overlay hardware has become much better over time. And now it's actually, we get pretty good hardware that can do a lot of things.
So our youngest listeners will not have experienced that, but I don't know if you remember, Chet, on Windows 95, for instance, when you were playing videos, it was using video overlays.
Oh, and you would see the flashing colors in the background.
That, yeah. Or if you move the window too quickly, yeah, the video overlay would lag behind. Uh-huh. So your window would lose the video and the video would be somewhere else on screen and then snap back. So that's how overlays were used before.
Actually, don't we have the same effect, or we did historically, with surface view?
Yeah, but that was more of an issue with our lack of synchronization at the window manager level. It was not really a hardware problem. Or
also, we just wanted to simulate this sort of retro effect.
Yes.
Yeah.
For people that missed it.
So something else that Matthias was working on when I joined Android in 2007, back then we were working on that device that never shipped, the Sooner. And that device did not have...
Should have called it the later.
Yeah. The never. That device did not have a GPU. So Matthias wrote an implementation of OpenGL ES1, 1.1 actually, I believe, in software. It was really cool because I remember, like, Quake was running on a thing,
yes,
at, like, with an 80 megahertz CPU, and it had the JIT, like you were generating assembly code.
Yes, and what was even, what I was kind of really proud of is that at the a little later when we were working on the G1, on some scenes the software render was a lot faster than the real GPU, because at the time the real GPUs were not that good or that real.
Yeah, they were more like graphics decelerators.
Yeah. Yes. So it was. So that GL software GL implementation had two parts, and in fact it was two separate libraries. There was a rendering library, low-level library that I called Pixel Flinger, was the only thing it could do was to draw a quad, not even a triangle. And when I mean a quad, I mean it's basically a rectangle where the left and right sides are not vertical. They can be anything. But and so the only thing it could do is draw quads and that were textured, and I think that's basically it. And that library had a handwritten JIT, and so basically it would generate in memory the assembly code to draw one scan line, and then there would be a loop in C that would call it however number of times was needed.
And the generated code depending on the blending mode, whether right. there's texturing and.
Yeah, so there was basically a structure, like a key that I think it was like maybe 128 bit or something. It was not really big. That contained all the data needed to represent what the essentially what we call now the shader, right. you know, would be. So it had how we were interpolating color, how many textures there were. It were limited to two actually. What was the texture mode, the blending mode, and all of that, and it would generate ARM code by hand. And actually, the code for that is really kind of really funny. It's kind of like my first JIT, kind of a, but it worked pretty well.
Yeah, and last probably,
yeah,
right?
And last, yeah.
And
hope,
we were
yeah.
still using that code until very recently in yes. the emulator.
Right. Yes,
right.
And also, I think in the bootloader. Or something,
yes.
yeah. Or the recovery screen.
Why is that? Is it because we don't have access to the driver at that point in boot?
Yeah, it's because we have access to almost nothing, and I think it's very limited in code size. So the thing with Pixel Finger was the library itself was ridiculously small, and the code it generated, like each piece of JIT generated was like a few hundred bytes, like. It really used not much resources, and so I think for the recovery, where you want to be very small, is
right.
good. And it was pretty powerful. Like if you use the Pixel Flinger part, just has essentially a blitter to draw bitmaps, it could do all kinds of things because it has essentially all the features you have in GL. So you could scale, rotate, transform, you know, and you could do that with several bitmaps.
Yeah.
So it's pretty powerful. You could probably write like a whole 2D engine based just on that. Like it did the main things that you needed to do.
And its function was to translate between like raw OpenGL code and these quads that it would actually render?
Yeah, so Pixel Flinger was just a library to draw textured quads. And glorified texture quads, and then there was the OpenGL library that I wrote on top.
I see
that used it as it essentially as a piece of hardware almost.
Yeah, right.
And then that implemented the OpenGL 1.0 or something.
So at the time, we did not use GL rendering for the UI until Honeycomb.
Well,
right. So
I had a prototype.
Well, right. But the question was, so what was this used for? So if we weren't using it in rendering, you know, was it
question.
Just for
So I had player? So before joining Android, I had a little bit of experience with mobile platforms. And it was really, really, really obvious to me at least that, you know, in the future I would be doing rendering using hardware, like software rendering was not like, in my opinion, was going to die.
I'll stop you there and say, yeah. So you wrote a software renderer.
I know.
Okay.
Because, yeah, and I will explain. So my idea was like, okay, so when we get hardware, most likely it's going to be GL. So I want everything to be ready for when we get hardware. The problem is we don't have hardware. We don't really know when it's going to happen. I think it's going to happen soon. Some people think it's never going to happen, whatever. So I thought, okay, I'm in charge of graphics. I'm going to pretend I have a GPU, but I don't have one. So I'm going to have to write one. and so I wrote a GPU, essentially. This was the idea. So this way, I was able to write Surface Flinger using GL, in quotes. I mean, it was using real OpenGL, but it defaulted to software. Which was okay because of the overlays most of the time. And then, you know, little by little, real hardware started to show up. And
then you just ported Surface Flinger on top of real hardware instead
right.
of Pixel Flinger.
Yeah.
Interesting. So how early did that happen then? This predated me.
So I think, okay. So on the G1, The G1 had hardware OpenGL, but it only had one context for the whole device, not per process. It was just one context for the whole device. So I think we kept it for the apps. So on the G1, the composition was done either by an overlay or by software OpenGL in Surface Flinger.
Actually, the same was true for several releases on the system side because of memory concerns.
Yeah, I think. Right?
So I think we used software GL so that we didn't incur the overhead of a GL context.
And,
all right?
Yeah, and I think
so. And that was our fallback, right? We really wanted to be in the overlays as much as possible.
And so I think on the G1, when an app said, oh, I want OpenGL, then the app would get the GPU.
The idea back then was that apps that would require the GPU would be most likely full screen games, in which case you can go directly to the hardware composer and we don't need it in Surface Flinger.
Right. And so with the what was it called? The device after that. The Droid, I think. Yeah, okay. It was a Droid. Then I think we had GL everywhere, like hardware okay. GL everywhere.
So it turns out you were right.
Yes, it also turns out that software GL library essentially never got used.
Right.
It got used a little bit at first, but it never really got used in production. I think some apps would request the software GL. I think some app did it because of compatibility sometimes, but like a long time ago. So this code has been,
That's a big project to never get used.
Yeah.
Well, it was used in the emulator.
Yeah, it was used in the emulator.
So a lot of people have been using it over the years.
Yeah. But I really think it was necessary to go through that step, if nothing else, to be ready for when the hardware is there and also to convince people that, that's what needed to happen.
Right. Nice. Okay. So that leads us into other areas. So that was Surface Flinger a long time ago, and you've continued to work on it off and on over the years.
Yes. But
it has been essentially stable for a long time now, right?
Yes. It evolved. So that's really interesting. There's kind of like this part in the code that, if we could have a heat map of where the code is changed, like it would be like glowing, glowing red or something. So there's parts of the code that have pretty much never changed in like a few files that kept, being updated. The way we were representing and handling layers has changed at least three or four times easily, significantly. But I think in the last four or five years, it's been pretty stable.
I think the last big significant change I remember, and of course I'm not in the team, so probably wrong, was the introducing triple buffering. And there was a whole lot more logic, maybe this hardware composer instead, but a lot of logic around like the handoff of the buffers between us and the driver.
Yes. So in fact, so that's a little bit my fault. So from day one, I didn't want to see tearing on the screen ever. This was kind of like my pet peeve. So I thought I wanted.
Didn't you ruin? I think it was Rebecca on the kernel team. She didn't know what you were talking about when you were mentioning tearing, and you showed her, and then she complained that you ruined her because now every time she sees tearing, that's all she sees.
Once you see it, and so I was like, there will not be tearing in Android.
Okay,
like,
describe for those people that haven't seen this.
Okay, let's describe tearing. So tearing first of all, it happens when you're drawing on screen when you're drawing directly on screen while the screen is being scanned out by the hardware. So what could happen is that the top half of the screen contains like an image, and the bottom half contains another image from the previous frame. And so if let's say you have an object that's moving left to right, so what's going to happen is that you're going to see it like tear in the middle of the object, like a tear. And you see that a lot on PC games because...
Or console games too.
Tearing reduces latency a lot, and so it's important for game. So it's like that happens when you do single buffer rendering. So you have one buffer and you render into it. So since I had decided that there will not be tearing in Android, Then that
you held
meant,
a meeting with the entire graphics team and you had consensus decision.
Yeah, we had some concerns and then we were good. and so then so that meant we needed to do what's called double buffering rendering. So you're drawing into an off-screen buffer, and while the current frame is displayed by the hardware, and when the hardware's ready, it's gonna switch to the now, you know, ready rendered buffer, and then you would switch back and forth between those two buffers.
Right, and that's called the vsync, the vertical sync.
Oh yeah, and you do that at the vsync. Yeah,
right.
And so that is great, but that has a downside, which tends to slow down the app, because when you think about it, what's going to happen is that once the app is rendered, it needs to wait, because it doesn't have another buffer to render into. One buffer is being displayed currently by the screen. Another buffer is rendered, so and then there's no third buffer, so the app just has to wait. And so what happens with that mechanism is that you end up slowing down the apps, usually. So the solution to that is to throw in a third buffer. And so, and that's what is called triple buffering. So what triple buffering gives you is kind of the best of both worlds. You don't get tearing, and the app can sort of draw as fast as it can. The downside is that it adds latency, and obviously it also consumes more memory.
Right.
So triple buffering was there from the beginning because of that.
Okay.
Yeah. And so what happened later is that we became more concerned. So two things that happened. First of all, originally, the apps were not synchronized with the vSync. But that was okay because we had three buffers, so they could sort of draw whenever they felt like it, and they would not be slowed down. But that would create kind of uneven animations, like when, because essentially the frame rate of animations would not be constant.
Yep. It was a frame pacing issue.
Yeah. And so the app would draw as fast as it could, so there was no inefficiency, but the animations would not look very good. They would not look really buttery smooth kind of thing. So that's what was happening at the time. So at some point we became concerned about, you know, sort of like fixing these problems around the time where we did like all the project butter and all of that.
Oh, Jelly Bean.
Yep. And so two things happened then. We started to synchronize the apps with the vSync. So that would guarantee that they would draw at a known pace that was matching the pace of the screen. So the animations would be...
It was not just about drawing, but when we run an animation, we have to sample the current time of the system to know where we are in the animation. So
absolutely.
What that guaranteed is that we would always have the same delta, more or less, mm-hmm. between two frames of animation, whereas before, like you said, you know, it could be 4 milliseconds, 20 milliseconds, 8 milliseconds. And that's what contributed to making the animations feel jerky.
Yes. And so we did that. And then at the same time, we also were concerned about reducing latency. And so that's when we introduced, in fact, the double buffering option. So, and it's kind of automatic. So by default, an app starts in sort of double buffer mode, and it starts to do its work. And if the app falls behind, so that means if it renders too late for the frame to be displayed on time on screen, what we do at this point, we throw in a third buffer, so the app can continue to do its job. And at that from that point on, the app is in triple buffer mode. So what you see on screen is that you see like one kind of like one frame missing. So you see a little like stutter in the animation. You see just one. And then after this one, it's smooth again, but the app is one frame more behind.
Right.
So and it continues like that until the animation stops. And if the animation stops, then it falls back again into the two frame mode.
Right. And the latency, like it's not noticeable in most situations where, like if it's just an animation or you're watching a video or whatever.
Yeah, you don't care.
Latency is irrelevant. The place where you might notice it is the input events just added a frame of latency, right? So the time between when your finger touches the screen and the time that the screen updates in reaction to that touch has increased by whatever, 60 milliseconds.
You will notice it each time the graphics is depends on something that's happening in the real world. So it could be sensors or
a good example too is drawing applications. Mm-hmm. If you're drawing with your finger, it's going to be pretty noticeable.
Yeah. Right.
Whereas it's less noticeable with drags or clicks or...
Yes, and so at that time, so now we have sort of these two modes where I can do triple buffering if needed or double buffering.
So you're saying we always had triple buffering, so what you added in Jelly Bean was the option, was the default to start out in double buffer mode and then add a third buffer as necessary.
Yeah.
I see. I had it all backwards.
Yeah.
Okay.
The things you learn.
Yeah.
That's why I do this podcast, actually.
Yeah, I know.
And then I forget them again.
You're so trying to learn Android, really.
Yeah. One of these days. So that's a lot about surface flanger. You've worked a lot, like back then and since then, I think in general, you tend to do sort of low-level optimization stuff.
Yes, that's true. I mean, that's sort of often the case when you work on graphics.
Right.
Well, I remember that around the Jelly Bean time, you know, when Project Butter was going, Matthias and I have been sharing an office for years and years, and our office was basically sys-trace 200% of the time. We're just sys-tracing the system.
Use sys-trace.
Yep. Yes.
If you don't know how to use it, learn.
And if you think it's really complicated, you are correct. But it's just
it's not true. I think it's very intimidating.
Yes.
Yeah. But it's not complicated.
True. I think the presentation, this is probably on us to fix. The presentation of the information is complicated. That is the problem, right? If you look at the sys-trace output, you don't know where to start.
I find it's true of most profilers, though.
Yeah.
By definition, they will show you so much information and they all tend to be intimidating. And
It's true. I think the extra factor with sys-trace is that you're seeing a lot of information that you probably don't understand anything about and probably don't care about for your specific situation. So, for example, if you look at trace view output, everything you're seeing on the screen, there's a lot of information there, but it is all information generated by your application. So you should kind of understand what's going on. Whereas if you're looking at CPU frequency data on sys-trace, what am I supposed to do with this? Or the green and blue bars that indicate when something went to sleep. Yeah. So it's not obvious what
sys-trace,
it all means.
That's true. Sys-trace is more a tool for looking at the whole system.
Yeah.
It's almost like looking at the system from the fourth dimension or something. You can see it.
But it's not complicated.
Yeah. But you see everything.
Right.
So Matthias has been doing a lot of low-level optimizations. I mean, just the fact that he wrote a JIT for OpenGL, I think, shows that he knows a little bit about that kind of stuff. And lately, for instance, I know you were doing some low-level optimizations around it's graphics code in a way, but it's not really about putting pixels on screen. It's more like the kind of stuff that goes around graphics code. And you've been doing a lot of interesting changes and discoveries. And so can you say more about that?
Yes. So the first thing I think I want to say is that you often hear that, you know, premature optimization, the root of all evil, blah, blah, blah. I don't think so. I think it's important to have performance and optimization in mind when you're writing code, especially new code. It's not to say that you want to optimize everything from day one, but I think it's important to have an idea.
I would qualify that a little bit and say one thing that I found very useful over the years is to understand or at least have some rough idea of what happens. So, you know, understanding what your library does when you call it, understanding what the compiler outputs when you do some operation, understanding the capabilities of your CPU or your tight loops.
Yes, and get an idea of what the performance of something should be. You know, should it take a second or should it take like a millisecond? You know, at least within like a 10x, you know, be in a 10x of what it should be, you know. Because otherwise, there's no way to. You'll never get performance at the time where you're trying to do your optimization. If you're off by 1,000 times, then it's gonna be. You may have to rewrite so many things. So this is just the point I wanted to make. I think it's the root of all evil thing is a little bit too dangerous of a saying, and I don't like it. So yes, lately, so I. I must admit, I think micro-optimizations are... you often hear that, it's kind of useless and you should not spend time on this. The compiler will do the right thing, all of that. And it's somewhat true. I just happen to like doing micro-optimizations.
Well, it also depends on what piece of code you're working on, right? Like if you're doing a network call, like the time it's going to take for the data to go across the network, it's going to dwarf whatever your code is doing.
Yeah.
But when you're writing a loop that does, calling or clipping, you want to go as fast as possible.
Exactly. And so... And I personally like doing that, so it doesn't. I think it's kind of fun. So I do spend some time looking at what the compiler generates. Most of my work is in C++, so there are tools to disassemble the code, and I will once in a while I will kind of do a survey of like the important piece of the code, and I'll see what did the compiler do there. And at times I'm amazed. I'm like, this is amazing what the compiler was able to do. And at times,
you're also amazed.
I'm also amazed
by
what it didn't do. And at times I'm like, why is that there? And it's because there's a bug or something I did in the code that I didn't realize would translate to code being generated or something. Maybe I thought it would be inlined and it was not. So you catch a fair amount of things, but just looking. And sometimes it's really simple. You have a function in your code that, is in a hard pass, so you want it to be efficient. You look at the disassembly code. If it fits in a half a page of code, you're like, that's probably fine. But if suddenly it's like pages and pages and pages of assembly code, maybe something went wrong, and that has happened in the past. So it's always interesting to... I think it's an easy way to have a quick idea of...
like you said, sometimes it's good to have an idea of how much, how slow or how fast your code should be, mm-hmm. given your existing hardware, and measure it and see how far you are from the theoretical performance of the CPU. A good example is, Mathias and I worked for a little while on robots, and Nicolas, who wrote Constraint Layout, was with us. And so Nicolas was working on this telemetry application. So we're trying to gather data from the robot sensors at something like 80 kilohertz. So that's a lot of data that we're grabbing from the network, and we had to process it as fast as possible. And the code was definitely slower. We did the math, like back of the envelope calculation, and we saw that we were way off. And we inspected, we had this small loop that was, I think, one line of code in the loop. And all we did was hoist a call to a getter outside of the loop, because that getter was the same one on every time we would loop over. And that was enough to avoid a data cache miss in the CPU, and that was 150x speed up by just moving that little piece of code out of the loop. And that was, and we noticed that because we did that exercise of like, how far off are we? We should be 100 times faster. So clearly, we're doing something wrong.
It's strange. Like that's the kind of optimization that I would think compilers would do.
And that's the thing, like compilers, as Mathias said, they do incredible things. But there are several problems. So first of all, they might have bugs. They might have regressions from the previous version. And sometimes they don't necessarily have something that is clear to you. Let's say that you have your array is always a multiple of 4, and therefore like it could be vectorized. The compiler doesn't know that, or doesn't always know that. Or it doesn't always know that you're not going to write that data from another thread at the same time. So there's a lot of things that we take for granted because we understand the intent behind the code, but the compiler does not have that information. And more dangerously, we saw when we see the compiler do something amazing, my worry is always, next time we update the compiler, can we guarantee that the code will remain just as good? Because those optimizations are extremely complex for compilers, and the smallest change in your code base or their code base could just completely break the optimization. And so it's kind of dangerous to rely on it.
And one that a lot of people forget is, I don't know how it is in Java, but in C, one that people forget is that each time you have a function call, when you come back from the function call, the compiler cannot assume anything about... Or it cannot assume much about what is in variables, registers, whatever. So it will reread a bunch of variables that it already read before the function call, it doesn't know. So for example, something that works really well is to cache value that you need. Let's say you have an object you know, you're reading some members of whatever. Caching those members into a local variable, when you look at the code, it looks silly. Because you're like, well, why do you copy that in local variable? You could just use the member directly. But in fact, it does make a difference because each time you call a function and you come back, the compiler cannot assume that this member has not changed. But if you copied it into a local variable, it knows the local variable didn't change. So, and that makes a huge difference. But that's strange because the code looks bizarre. You know, instead of using a member, you know, M something or whatever, directly, it seems strange to first copy it, you know, into a local, but it does make a big difference.
Yeah, another thing that's interesting about, you know, going low level, and it applies to C and C++, obviously. Recently, we are using a tool called Binary Ninja to look at the assembly. With Java programming language in Kotlin, you can also look at the bytecode to make sure that, for instance, in Kotlin, you have all those high-level constructs, like you can use a for loop over ranges. But if you look at the bytecode, you realize that the compiler is really smart and does the right thing and doesn't generate objects. So it gives you like better confidence in your code and what you're doing. But also for shaders on the GPU, so if you spend some time decompiling your shaders and figuring out what exactly the compiler is doing, you can do that with Imagination Tech. They have decompilers, so you can see the output assembly. You'll realize that some pieces of hardware, so GPUs or CPUs, have very specialized functions. So GPUs, for instance, are able to, when you load the variable, they can give you the absolute value of the variable at the same time, like it's the same instruction. Or they can multiply it by 4 for free. Or you can get the negative version of that value for free, which kind of changes the way you write your code because, you know, then I know, just for safety, I can put a bunch of apps in my code to make sure I'm not going to have, you know, negative values all over the place, and I know it's not going to impact my performance. So it's something I don't have to think about now that I understand that the GPU can do it for free. So there's a lot of interesting. Or you know, an insight that Matthias had recently was showing me decompiled code. We had this value that we are clamping between 0.3 and something else. But the 0.3 was kind of arbitrary. We just needed to clamp in some range that had some kind of some sense. And turns out that if we change that 0.3 to 0.25, the generated code is much better. We save like a couple instructions and we save a load, a data fetch. And the reason is 0.25 is a power of 2. It's 1 divided by 4. And the compiler can generate a constant. Whereas otherwise, it has to store the 0.3 in the data section of the binary. It has to go fetch that data. So again, like, you know, you shouldn't worry about it 99.9% of the time. But if you're in this tight loop and you can do like those small optimizations, like, it can make a pretty big difference. I mean, not having to fetch that data means that you can run more operations in the meantime.
So how did you learn that? Was that by looking at the assembly output from the compiler?
Yeah, because you look at the assembly and usually your constants, you know, show as just hexadecimal values. You're like, why is it doing a load here? We're not loading anything. We just have constant. And then, you know, realization, oh, it's a float. So the compiler like doesn't know the representation of 0.3 because who does? And like Matthias says, it can be fun. It's an interesting puzzle. Actually, that's what it is.
Isn't that why we're in this field to begin with? It's all puzzles.
Aren't you in this field to just schedule meetings?
I'm not, but I'm very good at that, apparently. Very good. So thanks for coming today.
Thank you.
Thanks.